Hi, Chief Halton here at Fire Engineering Podcasts, and we are being brought to you by Tenkata Protective Fabrics and their Made for Life podcast hosted by Stuart Perry. The Made for Life podcast unearths the work experiences of real men and women who rely on the protective clothing and equipment to get the job done. From firefighters to industrial workers to military personnel, recent episodes explore the dangers and challenges of wildland firefighting, peer counseling for first responders, and the ins and outs of turnout gear. It's the Made for Life podcast from Tenkata Fabrics. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And thank you for listening to Fire Engineering.
Good afternoon. I'm in Miami, Florida, and my name is Bill Gustin. And I want to welcome you to a special edition of our hangout. This is going to be to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on our country. We were attacked in New York City at the World Trade Center, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and the Pentagon. I want to remind some folks that may have forgotten, or maybe you weren't even alive when that horrible day occurred, that we are at war, my friends. You may not think we're at war, and maybe we are not waging war against our enemies, but make it clear, we have enemies, and our enemies are diabolical, evil, vicious, and they are set out and determined and patient to wait years and years to destroy our American way of life, our freedoms. And especially if you have a wife, a sister, a daughter, how horrific their lives would be if these animals ever get a chance to take away our freedoms. I want to give a shout out to our friends at Key. That's keyhose.com, manufacturers of some of the finest hose. And I know it because I had my hands on it this afternoon, sweating my butt off, practicing hose loads. And that would be manufacturers of Key Combat Ready, the True ID, and the FDNY spec, all excellent hose. And as I say on every hangout, take the key challenge. Try to kink the key hose, and you will have your hands full. So I'll let our panelists introduce themselves. But before I do that, there's two panelists that are conspicuously absent today, and I want to give them a shout out. And one is to our brother, Captain Mike Dugan. And Mike is the keynote speaker at the memorial presentation for the United States Air Force at Goodfellow Air Force Base for September 11th Memorial Service. And he is going to be representing the fire service and FDNY. And I can't think of a better spokesman and representative. Also, our brother, Jason Hovelman, who usually sits here on this panel. I think it's most appropriate for me to just read this. Friends, this is from Jason. He's a chief in Forest Valley Fire Protection District. I will miss tomorrow as our region, including our department, will be involved in assisting in the return of a local Marine who was killed in Afghanistan. I apologize for missing and hope you have a great show. Captain Dugan, they could not have picked a better patriot presenting to them. So God bless those two guys. Clark, if you want to go ahead and we'll go right down the list there, introducing ourselves.
Yes, Clark Lamping from Clark County Fire Department, Las Vegas. Honored to be here as always. Honored to be a friend and a mentee of Mike Dugan, Captain Mike Dugan, and Chief Jason Hovelman. At FDIC, I just picked up Jason Hovelman's book. It's an easy read. It's a company officer book for new company officers. And I've been a company officer 12 years, and I still learned something from his book. So shout out to Chief Jason Hovelman and Mike Dugan, and looking forward to this conversation.
Daryl?
Hi, Captain Daryl Liggins, Oakland Fire. Recently got off the engine. I'm down here at the training division for my last couple of years here, and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Boss?
Sorry, I was getting some grapes. Bobby Halton, Limestone Fire Protection District number 2 in the great state of Oklahoma, northeastern Oklahoma, where we are not taking ivermectin prescribed for horses, contrary to the Rolling Stones story, which was complete fabrication. But God bless MSNBC and ABC and CBS and all the rest of them for running with it, a completely untrue story. So that's where I live.
That's green country.
Green country. That's exactly right. Where we are not taking horse dewormer, contrary to the Rolling Stones' opinion of us.
And this is actually going to be our subject matter expert for the day, Samuel Hiddle.
Yeah, how's everyone doing? I'm captain with Rescue 2, Wichita Fire. And I would like to say that that was a great opener, Captain. You may not want to address it, but it's real and it does need to be discussed.
And to add to this, we recognize and remember the 343 firefighters were killed that day, but that's going to be a pittance because the deaths since then from the rescue and recovery efforts because of respiratory illnesses is now at 220. I just took this from the Division 7 Training and Safety Newsletter. I think that's produced by Chief Jonas of the FDNY. Referring to the line of duty, yes, is box 558087. That's the World Trade Center. Three fellas that recently passed away as a result of their sicknesses resulting from the rescue and recovery efforts. And let's be clear about this. These people that are dying and are going to continue to die, they're every bit as much injured and killed in the line of duty as when the buildings fell down on these poor guys. It is still happening. This nightmare is far from over. So I want to recognize firefighter Wayne Goering, retired from Engine 311, passed away on July 19th. Paramedic Stephen McCoy, he was EMS station number 22. He was retired. And he passed away on August 6th. And Lieutenant Patrick Whalen, retired from Ladder 83, he passed away on August 22nd. So it's still going on. The nightmare is far from over and it will be continuing for quite some time, I'm afraid to say. So let's don't ever forget. I know it sounds like such a cliche, but it's if we forget, then we're doomed or damned to have the same thing happen to us again. So I want to just bring up our topic today, which is I have a lot to learn. I've never really embraced thermal imaging the way that I should, but I can tell you I was sullied. I was given the wrong impression. You know, first impressions are really important. My company was given an iris. I'm not going to mention the manufacturer. Okay, this monstrosity that fits on your helmet. Now, you can only see through the infrared lens. So you completely violate a basic tenet of using a thermal imager, and that's to get the friggin' thing out of your face and look under the smoke. And I never really embraced the concept after that, although now we've got a tick for every riding position on our apparatus. Of course, the price back then was like $18,000, and now we're getting them for about $5,000, I think. But we recently, Miami-Dade, in fact, it was on Fire Engineering's webpage, or will be, a search and rescue video, which I'm very proud of, and produced by, videoed by Robert Hernandez, and who used drone footage inside of a building. And he assembled a great room, living room, dining room, family room that opens to a kitchen. Now, that's a difficult space because it's hard to search because you don't have the frame of reference of walls, and it's got a large area. So you kind of have to like triangulate. Well, Juan did a great job, and he shot some video with the thermal imaging camera. And then I had Sam, who I knew knows his business about thermal imaging because I attended his class at Andy Frederick's training days a couple of years ago in Alexandria, Virginia. So I had Sam weigh in on it, and he told me what we needed to know, not what we wanted to know. So there were some flaws in that video. And because of Sam's input, we decided there's no way we can just take that video and put it out there as a standalone training resource because there's a lot more to this. And so I've asked Sam to kind of review for us the limitations of ticks and also the things that we can do to minimize those limitations and maximize the capabilities of the tick. So Sam, I'm going to let you have the floor for a while there, my brother.
Well, I'll tell you what, Captain, I'll kind of feed off of you, but the main thing that about thermal imaging is simply it's easy to appreciate what it can do. But what we have to appreciate is what it can't do. I know I got myself in trouble as a young firefighter, believing that it was a handheld fire coach. It was going to tell me everything I needed to know. And that's just not the case. And so one of the things that kind of shocks people if they sit through the class is we're going to tell you to put that imager down as much as we're going to ask you to pick it up. It's not an end all be all. It has some benefits. If we overuse it, it can hurt us. And if we underuse it, we may not be as effective on the fire ground as we want to be. And there's some of that just comes down to understanding how the imager works. And we're not talking about BSTs and microbolometers and how it's built, but just really how it works in and of itself. You know, we use temperature synonymous with a reading, but really what we're looking at is a heat flux, meaning everything's emitting or radiating through the electromagnetic spectrum, some sort of heat signature. So first and foremost, if that heat signature cannot emit to the camera, then it's not going to get an image of what's going on. The camera does not go out and retrieve anything. Everything has to actually go to the camera. And another thing that can kind of get us in trouble, and I'll probably just start off with this slide, and then I put together a few slides of things you may or may not want to discuss, but it doesn't see gas in a meaningful way, gas or air. And that can create a little bit of confusion for us. Now it does see smoke, but smoke has particulates, right? So it actually has somewhat of a surface area. But let me go to this one first. Tell me if my screen share doesn't work out. All right, is that sharing okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So what we're looking at here is one of the initial UL studies, and you can see this arrow. Can you see my mouse?
Yeah.
Okay. So you can see this arrow. The camera is right here, and what it's doing is it's pointing to the end of the hallway in a high pressure zone, meaning that as this fire in this bedroom right here, as it comes out, it's going to bypass that high pressure zone, and it's going to run down the hallway to the greater volume area, or where that door is open, and go to a low pressure. Now, if you look right in here on that tile with the green, you can see that green dot, okay? And it's reading 118 degrees at the end of that hallway because you don't have any convection on that wall because of that high pressure. But if you look at what the thermocouplers were telling us, coming out of that door, we had 1,000 degrees heat, which means that 1,000 degrees heat is traveling back and we're wearing it as we make our way down that hallway. So did that make sense?
Yes. I take that to a vaulted ceiling. That was the second floor overlooking a great room.
No, this was when we did the fire attack study. So this is just a simple hallway. And so one of the things is we know that if I look past where that thermal column is coming out at us, then I'm going to get a bad reading and I'm going to be feeling something that the camera is telling me isn't occurring. What we need to do is get people to start looking up at the ceiling because we do get that heat to rise and it's going to travel across the ceiling and create that convection. And so that's very prophetic. What happens up here will eventually happen to us down here if we keep going down that path without any mitigation. Another thing to talk about is the modes. And modes are very, very important. I'm going to go ahead and show this slide as well. We'll and talk over it. Okay. So what we have here is each camera is going to have like a low sensitivity or a high sensitivity, depending what kind of camera it is. They have different names for it. Normal mode, IE mode, EI mode. But basically, when the camera is in a high sensitivity situation, it's going to have a certain temperature. And for this MSA, it's a little above 300. So anything that shows up a little bit above 300 is going to actually be red. Okay. Now, when it goes into the low sensitivity mode, it's only using about 20% of its capability now. And anything that shows up again red is going to be 1,000 degrees. And this is really, really important that we recognize the mode we're in, because when we're in this high sensitivity mode where it's really concerned about small changes in temperature, it has smaller margins than when we go to the low sensitivity mode and we have a wider variety of temperatures or a wider range, meaning it might show us a difference between 10 degrees in high sensitivity and it might only show us the difference between 40 degrees in low sensitivity. But what happens is we see that red in the high sensitivity and it looks like the world is on fire when all we have is a nickel's worth of fire. And then at the end of this video, what you're going to see is it's going to switch into that low sensitivity mode. That red's going to go away and it's not going to show back up until it's 1,000 degrees. Now things look benign when we're actually in a more dangerous environment. So let's go ahead and play this video. Okay, so you can see where that would get us in trouble, right? Particularly if we're in those blackout conditions and we see red at the end of the hallway. If we're in that high sensitivity mode, then I know everything's fine. I mean, yeah, I've got some fire there, but I expected that, right? I'm in zero visibility. However, when I see that red show up again at 1,000 degrees, now that's significant because we're well past numbers that we know that we get flashover, right? We used to say 1,000. Now we're kind of accepting 800. And we've actually seen things flash at around 600 because we're making chemicals that scientists don't even have names for. I kind of like to refer to it as uncle mode. No one can remember every time their dad yelled at them, right? It was too frequent. However, the first time your uncle yelled at you, that was memorable. So I refer to it as uncle mode. If I see red, I want it to be meaningful.
Sam, if I can ask you, one of my biggest blunders I ever did, because what I mean by blunder is a company officer. It's not you only get yourself hurt, but you get your company hurt. I almost led my crew off of a balcony at an abandoned movie theater. And it was on a cold February day, cold by Miami standards. And it was a couple of mattresses burning. They had an encampment of homeless people living up on the second floor. And everything was basically the same shade of gray as it was in the video that I shared with you. And so what I learned from you in our conversation is and I'm sure you're going to get to this. Forgive me if I get ahead, but is the lack of depth perception and the lack of contrast between what is hot and what is not. But I do recall that when I would try out new thermal imagers, starting with the Iris, the salesman wanted to get us in that burn building as quick as he could, because that's where the image would be vivid. Whereas in the case of the movie theater, everything was pretty much the same shade of gray. But that was with an older generation of thermal imagers. Could you speak about that, or are you going to speak about that?
Yeah, it really does. It comes down to contrast, but we can do a lot of things to cheat it. We can change our perspective, meaning if I change my perspective, I might pick up something else with contrast. I might actually change the view of something to where it actually tells me there is a door, and I'll show you a slide here in a second to articulate that. One of the things we'll do in vacants when we have a lot of we don't have something that's climate controlled, so you do get something that's kind of acclimated to the same temperatures, as we'll kick a firefighter out in front. Just going to tell them, hey, go crawl out there 15, 20 feet, and they might provide enough contrast just for a door to pop out. Another thing we can do is actually roll our hand over the camera. So as we're looking, if we just kind of roll our glove over the top of that focal plane, that glove can give a little bit of contrast and make things appear different. And we can always ask the line to give it a wash. So one of the experiments, when we do this class, it looks like a meth lab, because all these things we talk about, we actually stand up and do experiments to show how it works in the real world. And one of the things we do at the beginning of class is we'll put a piece of paper on the door and we'll let it acclimate to the same temperature of this door. You can't see it. When you come up with a thermal imager and we take a spray bottle and just give it a little wash, and that's enough to bring that paper out on that door. Same thing in actual fire building or a vacant building. Just give it a splash with the nozzle, and it's going to create that contrast, because things absorb and release heat differently. That door will pop out for you. Now, we don't want to overwash it, because what happens if we give it too much of a wash is now we're just going to saturate it back the other direction where everything's just colder. So let me show this, because this is basically what happened to you, and it's really not that uncommon. All right, so what you can see here is you have these steps. But because the floor, the steps, and the floor that we're actually on are all this made up of the same molecular composition, then we're not going to get any kind of contrast. Now, when we talk about getting low to look low, meaning because of vanishing points, which is a whole nother discussion, when we look low, we need to put our head on the ground and we need to look. So the question is this: if you're up on top of that landing and you put your head on the ground to look low, what's going to happen to that door behind those stairs? Is that going to shrink down a little bit? Yeah, so that's going to be your indicator that you have an elevation change there. I know one of the crews, the captain there, he preaches anytime you come to a railing, they actually leave the roof hook, lean the roof hook up against the railing so they can find it again. For instance, if they get up onto a mezzanine, that way they run into the roof hook, or they might be able to see that with the imager before they go down it.
Hey, Sam, it's Daryl. Yeah. I have a question. I'm not too experienced with using thermal imagers, as our engines only got them maybe about, you know, four years ago or so. But I've had several times when attempting to use it, it's just basically whited out and didn't really help me. So that's one question, is, you know, what causes that? And my other question is, you were talking about different settings. I'd imagine it may be a little difficult to do with gloves, or, you know, and zero visibility, unless you're very, very familiar with it. Is there a setting that you recommend people, you know, to leave it on? Those are basically a couple questions I have for you.
Me personally, I like to leave it in grayscale because of what, like, I refer to as uncle mode. Color palettes, these imagers are difficult to use. I've spent a lot of time with them, and I have difficulty using them, particularly when I'm on a footprint that I've never navigated before. So adding color to it just creates a little bit more confusion to me. Like I said, I want red to be meaningful, something that pops out, and I have to pay attention to it.
Very good.
Now,
very good.
Referring to your original question, the whiteout is an old technology.
Yeah.
Basically, what you're experiencing there is just saturation, where everything in that room has acclimated and became the same temperature. And that's where we've got to kick a firefighter out or just give it a little bit of a wash. And then everything will start to pop out a little bit better for us. I actually deleted that one of possible slides to discuss. So let me see if this one has it. Another thing that, going back to what the captain was referring to earlier, is one of our issues that we have with the imager is depth perception. And one of the reasons we have that depth perception problem is we rely on shadowing of far more than we realize. And the imager is incapable of giving us that shadowing, at least right now. So I'm going to play this video just to show you how strong shadowing is. And when you take that away from us, it messes us up. What you're going to see is this basketball rolling. And the basketball is going to stay on the same trajectory the entire time. The only thing that's going to change is the shadowing. And because of the shadowing, we get a completely different perspective of what we think the ball is doing. So right now, this basically looks like whiteout, right? This is where you just have a lack of contrast. But this is an example that if you scan around and you just get that little heat signature up at the top that's remaining, see how that changes that and brings that out.
Mm-hmm.
And here is an example. This is about 150 yards away, maybe 200 yards away. It's an apartment building. And all I do is roll my hands just barely over the top of the focal plane to create some of that contrast. And you can see how this brings it out a little bit better. See my hand come down.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, and I would encourage you, just as a firehouse experiment, put a piece of paper on the wall, on a door, and give it 30 minutes. Go look at it with the imager and then take a spray bottle and just give it a little spritz, and that thing will jump out, especially you loving the engine work as much as you do.
Fellas, we're at the halfway point. I just I want to thank our friends at Key. That's keyhose.com. Our good friend Peter, the man behind the scenes, Porquillo, just posted a what we call the triple U evolution using a Key Combat Ready 2-inch hose with 2.5-inch couplings. Would not have been possible with a hose that doesn't have remarkable kink resistance, because you're laying 225 feet out in about 30 feet of space. So you got a lot of bends and turns. So you're just inviting kinks. But like I said, take the Key challenge. You're not going to find better hose, and you won't be able to kink it. So go ahead, Daryl. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, thank you. Sometimes with the, you know, engine work, we talk about things that happen in training that could actually be counterproductive when it's a actual fire. Things like penciling come to mind, where, you know, a flashover container can differ quite a bit from an actual building on fire. Are there things that you find that we do in training that's going to be counterproductive to actually using these thermal imagers in a fire that you'd want people to know about?
There we go. I would say probably one of the biggest things regarding training is we have to build up the muscle memory, meaning we've got to do all the things we did before plus some new things now. And I always use the example, when I was a younger firefighter and I first started getting interested in these, I would come in the morning and I would check out the imager, and then I'd be like, oh, I want to go talk to my captain about this fire I saw in fire engineering or online somewhere. And I would go walk through the app bay with the imager, right? And I thought I was doing a good thing. I was looking through the imager while I was doing it. And what did you think I did when I became an officer and I actually started carrying it? I just started walking around, right? And part of that is because we have a true disconnect in being able to see. We think we can see because we can, but we have limited sight, and we can get into the peripheral limitations of that here in a second. But one of the things we can do for training to get people to start doing all the things they did before is actually make them give you a temperature. Make them identify the temperature of the floor, make them identify the temperature of the ceiling. We'll hang stuff like boots and helmets right inside the doorway, because one of the things we want guys to do is as soon as they come in the door, we want them to look straight up and get a temperature. And so if you hang some obscure things like that in your training tower, they should be able to say, hey, I've got a boot hanging on the ceiling. Okay, well, that tells you that they're practicing good scanning, because the reality is we all start to train to our tower. We start to train to our buildings instead of the concepts, right? And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we don't want to look like we're incompetent to one another.
Sam, I think it's Houston that, because we just had a viewer weigh in on that initial, should it, an imager be used with an initial attack? I think that was the comment, but we had discussed, Sam, and I think we're along the same lines, get that baseline temperature. It's not as important what it is, it's just relative. And then you want to allude to that a little bit more?
Yeah, so the conversation that the captain and I were having was, I'm going to use an EMS analogy. I hate to use EMS because it stands for every minute sucks, last three letters and problems, but the reality is this. If you have a trauma patient and you don't take vitals for 15 minutes, what does that tell you about the patient when you take those vitals? It basically tells you what you have, right? Now, if you take them 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and 15 minutes, now when you take that 15-minute mark, what does that tell you? Basically, are your interventions working, right? Are things getting better? Are things getting worse? And so that's where we talk about the same thing with getting a temperature of the floor, getting a temperature of the ceiling. Firefighters typically don't get jammed up in flashovers at the front of the building. We get jammed up because we went too far. So if I come in the room and I scan up and I get a good temperature or a baseline reading of that ceiling, and we're not talking about accurate temperature, we're talking about what our camera tells us. Right? It could be 100 degrees off. That doesn't matter. So say our camera says a 700 degrees when we first enter the room, and we want to go deeper into the building and we're getting ready to exit a door. Now we need to back scan. And when we back scan, we're going to get a quick temperature reading again. So now it's 850 degrees. Well, we got to make some decisions. Where are we at with ventilation? Where's the hose line? Right, because if it's 850 degrees and the hose line's not coming and we don't have any ventilation on its way, do we really want to keep going? What if we come in and it says 700 degrees and we get ready to leave that room and it's 600 degrees and we have hose lines in place? Okay, things are getting better. We feel like they're going to hold that room for us and we can keep navigating. To answer your first question, Chief, before we answer this one, yes, that slide did say that.
So, are you, Sam, you are seeing the chat questions. I think that you Nick Salmea, I believe that's how you say it, had a great point about just fire attack. But the second part of Nick's question is intriguing. The hand option, does that work when you're doing an interior on the fire compartment as well? I know you were exterior when you did it in your demo. Will it work interior?
Yeah, because basically it's going to work opposite. So the video I showed was winter, and I put a warm hand in front. So that's, we have cold versus warm, so we have contrast. When we go into a fire, we're typically the coldest thing in there, right? Initially, particularly the inside of our hand. That's usually deflects or is hidden from a lot of the heat flux that we absorb. So yeah, now what we're going to do is we're going to take a heated environment and we're going to drop a colder glove in front of it. So there again, we get a contrast.
Sam,
or you can run your hand in front of the line and get some cold water on it.
Sam, I want to ask Clark something, because we're going to switch gears. It still has to do with ticks, but it has to do with those miserable rooftop unit calls, Clark, when you were on the strip. And I know it's way, way over 100 degrees with that that sun reflecting off the membrane roof, which is either white or silver. Can you tell us about the problems you've encountered using the tick, how successful you were, and when everything is so hot from the radiant heat of the sun, Clark?
Yes, Cap. What you're talking about is we have the big, huge roof-mounted AC units in Las Vegas, and we typically have our roofs covered by a TPO, a bright white thermal plastic olefin, and that's our waterproofing membrane. Our operations in Clark County very, very frequently burn up these AC units because it's so hot, and the call will come in, smoke inside of a commercial building, and it's either going to be a light white smoke, it's going to have an electrical smell, or a smell of rubber burning. And as soon as we get those notes, we're pretty confident on what we have. It's an AC unit. We either have an electrical burnout, or we have a belt is burned up, and it's sending the white smoke from the burning rubber through the building. So first truck company on scene typically goes to the roof, and some of these big buildings, you could have 20, 30 of these units lined up. And I'm looking at a sea of AC units, and all I have is something is causing a smell. And so we have to systematically start investigating what's going on, have them turn on, all right, have the occupants turn on the AC unit that they think is causing the problem. And I'm gonna hang up this phone, hang on. So we have to try to figure out which unit is causing us the problems. One thing we do is have them turn it on, and we can see if all the units are working. We have one that's not working. Another strategy we use is to go put our nose on every unit. We're going to try to smell for electrical. We're going to try to smell for burning rubber, and then use a thermal imaging camera. Well, these rooftops, like you said, Cap, these AC units could be 125, 130 degrees each, not even running. That's just the heat of the roof and the Las Vegas sun. So we have to try to distinguish, like Sam Hiddle said, all right, we have to get a baseline. I'm going to put my tick on this one. All right, this is showing 120 degrees. This one, 120 degrees. This one, all right, now I've got one that's 225 degrees. All right, we might have a problem here. But you have to start with the baseline, your EMS, and start investigating that. So it is a valuable tool. It is a miserable, miserable call to try to discern this. And then once you do figure out which AC unit is causing you the problems, you take the panels off. We have a roof AC bag, we call it. You take the panels off, and 95% of the time you see your electrical panels burned up, or you have ground up rubber in the well where the belt goes.
Yeah, I want to give a plug to our training minutes and also a class that was at FBIC, I believe, on RTUs, rooftop units, by a firefighter that had been in the HVAC trade, and very informative. There were several of these, starting with the basic nomenclature and then in function and then the troubleshooting. So if you want to take a look at and get more information on investigating the RTUs, rooftop units, they are in Fire Engineering's archive and Fire Engineering's training minutes. So I want to give a plug to our brother. I think he's from Connecticut. So thank you, Clark. Sam, so we talked about the depth perception. We talked about another thing you corrected us on is penetration into a room, a space, that if you don't go deep enough, you're going to get a limited view in terms of peripheral vision. Could you allude to that? You're muted, Sam.
Okay, I'm going to screen share again here.
There you go.
Basically, what we're talking about is field of view, and probably the easiest way to look at this, it's like a flashlight, okay, that light beam that comes out, right? If I get really close to a wall, that kind of tightens up a little bit, and it doesn't show as much of the wall, right? And if I back up from the wall, then that cone gets a lot larger, and the light hits more of that wall. That's kind of the way the field of view of your camera works as well. So let me see where I was at here. Okay, so I'm gonna use the MSA 6000 because that's what we use. But basically this thing sees wider than it does up and down. So if you're standing at 5 foot, the 37 degree cone, like that flashlight, when it comes out, you're not going to see anything in front of you for 15 feet. And that's pretty significant. If we're kneeling down and we're at 3 feet, we're not going to see anything in front of us for 9 feet. And this kind of comes back to doing more when we train. We still have to sound the floor, because if I can't see the floor in front of me for 9 feet because of these limitations, is it likely that I could fall in a floor when I open up that front door? Absolutely. When we go into a room and now we're seeing wider, so now we're at 48 degrees. If I just look straight ahead, you can see how much of this 10 by 20 room actually gets missed because of the peripheral limitations. Even if I start to scan, if I don't scan all the way over until I hit a wall, then I'm still going to miss a pretty good pocket. And that's easy to miss somebody in a corner. It's easy to miss a door or something along those lines. So, you know, one of the things that we teach is you put your foot up against the wall or you put your hand up against the wall. If I have the camera in this hand, as I come over and this is up against the wall, if I'm wiggling my fingers, then I know that I maximize that peripheral view till I hit the wall, right? In this hand, as I come over, my hand will actually hit the wall, and I know that I maximize the peripheral view of that room when that happened.
Hey, Sam, I could share a couple of stories that I learned, and one of your slides reminded me of it. The first story was I think I was the first one to use a thermal imaging camera in the fire department. They delivered all the cameras to the department. We took them out. We put them on the charger. I was at a truck company that day. I have been on a truck once or twice. And a box comes in for a warehouse fire. And I go to the truck and I remember the camera. So I ran back in the office, grabbed the camera. Anyway, we get there. We cut the roll-up door and we just have heavy smoke coming out of the roll-up door. They have a couple lines spraying in there. And the slide that reminded me of this was the convection currents I could see in one of your first slides in the direction they're moving. I distinctly remember seeing the currents moving strongly from left to right. And so we directed all the streams over there to the left because it seemed like, well, that's where the heat's originating from. And it was up in an upper mezzanine of a cabinetry shop. And a lot of the members there thought that was kind of neat. I guess before sharing the next story, do you have any comments on that? It wasn't something we had been taught, but it seemed pretty evident at the time.
You're absolutely spot on. And that's why I left this one in there. Like I said, we're not going to see air. We're not going to see gas in a meaningful way, but we can see smoke because it has particulates. It has some sort of surface area. And just like we used to teach people, if you wanted to leave, you used your flashlight and you'd follow the smoke out, right? So what you're saying is absolutely brilliant and spot on. You followed the smoke back upstream to figure out where you wanted to go, to where the source was. And here's a small video kind of showing that. And this isn't even real significant smoke by any means, but you can see it moving. So I'm glad you shared that because you're absolutely right.
Yeah, the second story, and not to be long-winded, I had a couple of lessons, and this is prior to the engines getting them, but really sold me on having cameras because I think a lot of departments go through a point in time where they're debating if they find value in it or not. It was a vacant grocery store, and we entered and we couldn't find how to get to the fire. We knew there was a window of fire in the back. We're crawling around, can't find it, come out. One of the members hands me a tick. And when we look through the tick, I could clearly see a doorway that's white. And I could see the firefighters on the hose line and kind of funneled everybody, hey, this is where to go, showing people the camera. And so it led us to the seat of the fire. Once we get back there and we're putting this out, I have my member on the nozzle. I'm kind of what Ray McCormick calls the umpire position, next to the nozzle and the backup. I said, hey, move that stream over here to the right. I'm showing him the large body of fire over to the right. And he moves it, and that inch and an eighth stream hits the back of the camera, and it was like knocking a baseball off of a bat. That camera just went flying out of my hands about, you know, 100 feet away. And now I had no camera, and it's like, oh, crap. Anyway, we continue this firefight, and things start deteriorating, and we decide, hey, we're in a vacant building that's going south. Let's get out of here. So we, as we back out of the building, I remember thinking, I really wish I had a camera right now, because I don't know if there's a firefighter off this hose line or on the wrong channel. I'm holding onto the bale. We get outside, we do a quick head count. And I knew the value of, you know, the responsibility I have to make sure all the members are out. I really lost some, the ability to do that when I lost the camera. So point was learning to have that camera lashed to me in some fashion, because walking around the firehouse, like you said, you're just holding it in your hand. And that's what I was doing. And also, what a great tool it is to have some accountability of people, whether it's leading them to the firefight or leading them out of it. And that really sold me on having that thing with me all the time.
Daryl, we've been using the spring-loaded lanyard, you know, hooks onto your breathing apparatus.
And yep. And that's what we got now.
And then you can let it go, and it just retracts. You have another important lesson there. There's another lesson there, and that is don't be too overly reliant on the tick.
100%.
You had to switch gears, man.
And it could have been the batteries run out or something, and all of a sudden you're in the dark.
Yeah, or you know, a lot of things could happen. But I'm going to air my department's dirty laundry. Yeah, we at times have become overly reliant on ticks. And they also don't take the place of the back of your hand. Smell of smoke, smell of wood burning, looking around. Oh my God. Oh, I can see a heat signature on this wall. Open up that wall. It was a friggin' hot water pipe, for God's sake. You know, it doesn't take the place of the back of your hand. But for overhaul, we have prevented so many rekindles by getting up in a smoky attic and taking a look across and seeing if anything is still smoldering using a tick, which I know that we would have left even with cellulose insulation, which is a real problem. And I think you all know that. But, you know, you can look up in a smoky attic and you can see something that's just, again, it's relative. It seems to be hotter than everything else. Well, let's go ahead and take a look. And,
all right, Captain, I've got another experiment for you.
Yeah, okay.
So what you do is take a match, okay, and light the match and then blow it out. And when that match starts to smoke, pull it down below the desk line, and then have the imager. And the imager will not see that smoke, okay? But then take a flashlight and run the flashlight over it, and you'll get reflection off of that smoke. So when we talk about overhaul, we actually teach people to do both, particularly when you get in border situations, because that camera can't see the surface areas. There may be a pile of clothes and all the junk that is smoldering. And if the camera can't penetrate through the stuff that we cooled with the hose line to see that, then it won't tell us. But if we take that flashlight and we just skim over the top of the piles, you'll see that tiny wisp of smoke reflect off of that light. So we actually teach both. And I could show, I've got a slide where I learned that one the hard way.
Okay. Cellulose insulation is such a problem. And hey, Daryl, if you have to leave, brother, God bless you, man. And you're taking off for the day. So
I have I got all the chiefs here. And I need to be in a meeting. So,
okay, Daryl.
Thank you guys.
All right. See God bless you.
You tell those chiefs you're already in a meeting.
Yeah. All righty. Bye bye.
We'll see you next. See you next month, brother.
Bye bye.
So, Sam, so, Yeah, the overhaul is something that has really, really helped us. But now I'm intrigued with this, the flashlight and the smoke, especially with the cellulose insulation, because it's so difficult. It's so insidious because it does tend to burrow and tunnel, but there is a certain amount of smoke that's given off. So you're recommending, I want to make sure I follow you, Sam. We've got an attic, we had a fire, and we've got cellulose insulation, which means we could have fire anywhere. And it's, without taking it all out, you really don't know. So are you saying use your flashlight to just scan the attic with the thermal imager like this, and you're going to see the flashlight will illuminate the smoke? Was that the idea?
So we got called one night for smoke in the attic. Now, using the imager initially, scan the attic. If something jumps out, then yeah, you probably want to focus on that, because it's been there long enough that that you have enough conduction for that thing to come through, or admission for that to give you a heat signature, right? So that's something to focus on. But if the imager is not showing you anything, then come back with the flashlight. And particularly in the dark, the darker the room, the more reflection you'll get off of that smoke, because you know we're dealing with light colored smokes at this point.
Yeah,
we're not dealing with high carbon smoke, right?
Yeah.
So to this day, we have no idea how, but we got up in this lady's attic, and when we started scanning from underneath with the imager, looking for saturated hot spots where it had transmitted through, and we were up in the top scanning with the flashlight on top of the cellulose, we ended up finding 4 different spot fires in this lady's attic.
Sam Hiddle, the words green and sustainable are not always the firefighter's friend.
You know, here's what cracks me up about green. We want to talk about green construction in the fire service. The construction industry is still arguing over 3 different parameters that define green. So right now, green can mean a whole lot of things to us. It can mean reduced lumber in the building process. It can mean plastics. You know, these synthetic shingles that we're putting on roofs that have 50-year warranties. Can last up to 100 years. That's considered a green product.
Sam, I've got a question for you. We were told at a class once that if you have a gas leak, suspected gas leak, if you use your thermal imaging camera, you can go scan around the gas meter and you could tell because the gas coming out of the ground is much cooler than the ambient temperature. But from what you told me in your class, because it is a clean gas, you're not going to be able to detect gas because there's no particulates in it. Is that true?
So here's the thing. It's not going to pick up the temperature. It's going to see through and not really pick up the temperature in a meaningful way. But you are going to be able to see it to some degree. And the reason is because water is a reflector, right? And if you have water vapor in the gas product, particularly depending on the type of gas product you have, then the water vapor will give you some sort of visual indicator that it's there, if it's significant enough. It depends on how much it's been scrubbed. So there again, you know, this is one of those times where we're going to say, hey, bring it, use it, don't rely on it. But if you have other senses, kind of like the captain was talking about earlier, for instance, we don't really use it on our 360s. I can give you 7 different temperatures off of the same window based on a whole lot of different parameters, but that imager, looking through that imager, will not tell me nearly what using my eyes will, and listening and feeling.
Now, there is an exception to that, Sam, and that is your strip shopping center, your warehouse with multiple bay doors, where it will tell you, get you an idea where the fire occupancy is.
Yes.
Looking at that. Other things, Sam, came to mind. You got a water flow in a warehouse, broken sprinkler pipe, or you had a fire. Big box warehouse. Take your tick, look at the sprinkler piping. follow the darker piping, which is the colder piping. That's the piping that water is running through. Follow it back. Eventually, it'll lead to the riser.
Absolutely. And we've done that before as well. Going back to what we were saying, where you can tell, we don't use it on the 3060 initially, but we will use it to augment if we don't have the information or feel like we have the information that we need. Then we pick up the camera and we start looking for that bay door that's a little bit hotter. So I certainly didn't mean to mislead that we won't use it, but we use it more as an augmentation tool than a tool to tell us what to do.
Well, I don't know about the rest of our viewers, but combine this with the tutorial that you gave me the other day, Sam, and you know your business, and you truly are a subject matter expert. I want to thank our viewers that, yes. Hey, I'm in charge. I'm saying, and I got more. We got the same amount of bugles, but I got the time on you, okay? All right. So, and I want to thank our people for weighing in, that have been our viewers, that is. And, I want to thank Key for, our friends at Key. And, I want to remind everybody that, never forget 9/11/01, because if we do, we are doomed or damned to repeat it sometime in our future or in our children's future. So God bless you in this most noble profession, brothers and sisters, and God bless America. Until next month, Bill Gustin, any final words, Clark?
I really enjoyed this talk. Thank you, Sam. Thank you. I learned a lot. And never forget, for sure.
Sam, anything?
Nope, that's all I've got, Captain.
All right. All right, fellas. God bless you guys. God bless America. We'll see you next month.